The Winners Club, the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse. World-class speakers who include billionaires, business icons, and elite level performers from across the globe.
So this is room number one of a series of four all about managing brand reputation in the roaring 2020s with Rob Flaherty, the chairman of Ketchum, in conversation with David Gallagher and John O'Brien. David and John, I will hand the reins over to you, my friends.
Hey, thanks. We drew lots, and I think, John, we agreed the first question, so I hope that's your understanding. Glad to see you on stage.
Great to be.
Hey, I just want to tell one little story, not to embarrass you. You might have been a little bit embarrassed if you'd heard me bragging about my longstanding friendship and benefits of working for you over the years. So I'll spare you that. But I just want to tell a little story about what I think reflects your leadership style. And I want to say it partly because I think it says something about you, but I want it to let people know that they're free to ask you questions and participate in the process we just outlined. So I was saying, Rob, you and I have been literally almost to every continent together, I think, in all sorts of conference rooms and all sorts of settings. And we could spend a lot of time reliving some great stories. But I remember once we were leading a workshop for young leaders. It's called, well, doesn't matter what it's called, but for young leaders at Ketchum, kind of entering the management level of their careers. And we were in Quebec, Canada. And we had an afternoon free. And I think a lot of businesses would have elected to spend that time, I don't know, on the golf course, in the bar, doing something else. And you actually found a playground in an economically challenged area outside of Montreal for us to spend an afternoon cleaning up, redecorating, refurbishing, re-landscaping as a reminder of the need for giving something back to the community, knowing where we come from, knowing where we're going, and what service leadership is about. So you don't have to comment on that. I just wanted to tell people that's the kind of leadership style you bring, and hopefully they'll feel comfortable asking some questions later. So I was just going to jump right in with the question, but I don't know if you had anything you wanted to say as an opening comment, or if I can just get right into.
Well, all I'll say is that is still there. And it is called Park Ketchum. I'm very happy that you remember that, David.
Yeah, I won't forget it. And I think we probably did find our way to a bar afterwards. But no, that was a it was a good start. So, we've had a couple of conversations, you and I, and then we were with the kind of planning team for this series. And you'd said something very intriguing about us hopefully moving through this pandemic and all the hardship associated with it, and I want to knock on wood and not tempt fate, but I think we're moving through that. And you talked about us moving to a new roaring 20s, and I just thought that was a fascinating concept, especially looking back to the last time we went through something similar. So I don't want to use the word unprecedented. I think that's been too precedented in its use, but we're clearly moving to something different. And I know you talk to boards and CEOs and CMOs. How are they looking at the next 18 months, the next 6 months? We know businesses like dependable forecasts. They like some sort of predictability. But we live in such a unforecastable, unpredictable time. So what are you seeing over the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months?
Yeah, well thank you very much, David. And thank you, John and James and Paul, for inviting me. I've been enjoying my time on Clubhouse. I love the format, and I look forward to any and all questions that you have. I'd like to say that the boards and CEOs that I've been talking to are fully anticipating what's going to happen in the next year, but I'm not seeing as much of that as I'd like. And frankly, I think that those of us in corporate communications and brand marketing on a good day do help management to see around corners, to anticipate social change, and sometimes along the way to stir the conscience of the corporation. And frankly, I hope that's what our discussion helps you to do as we go through this. So I'm not an economist or Nostradamus, but I have been closely watching human behavior and social change for decades. And I absolutely believe something quite extraordinary is about to happen, something we have never seen before. If you thought the past year had events and moments that you had never seen before. I think the next year actually might be equally astonishing, but in a very different way. The subtitle of this discussion is Opportunities and Risks, and so I will jump back and forth between what I see as major upsides and some very perilous downsides. If you're involved in brand marketing, brand reputation, or corporate communications, I'd like you, or just about anything, if you're an entrepreneur, think more deeply about what's happening if you haven't already. We are staring into the new roaring 20s. But I think of that in two ways, right? The obvious one is the economy is going to be booming and there's a lot of opportunity. There's going to be a lot of wild consumer spending. It's going to be an amazing time to be selling goods and services. But I'd like to also have you think of it like the roar of an angry lion. Only in this case, the roar is of the disenfranchised, the underrepresented, the have-nots. The pandemic laid bare, even more obviously than in the past, economic disparity, racial disparity, haves and have-nots. And that set of people, not homogenous at all, but is newly empowered and angry. Unemployment remains high among many of them. And we have to go into this with a sensitivity. I think of millennials and Gen Z, who are yet another generation burned by the crucible that they encountered as they were finishing high school and entering university. And think of the Black Lives movement, the Me Too movement, and the fight over so many issues facing us now. So while we're about, think positively about the roaring 20s, but let's think about that roar in two ways. So on the upside, the economy, to just pick two major economies, the UK and the US, are expected in GDP terms to grow between 6.5% and 7.5% in 2021 and about 3-4% in 2022. This is an increase that has not been seen since post-World War II era of around 1951, 70 years ago. And the UK economy grew by 0.5% in the first quarter. So all of that growth is going to happen in the second half of the year, going to shoot through the roof. And this, of course, does create a huge opportunity to promote brands and to sell goods and services. It's a great opportunity to show brand leadership and establish a new order among brands, a new post-pandemic order in which challenger brands and startups emerge as the new leaders. So, you know, fitness brands, think from Peloton to health clubs, have gone through major upheaval. Food brands, too, as the way we eat, how the food is delivered to us, where we eat, has changed dramatically. Snacking replacing meals in some setting. People developing whole different patterns of consuming food and beverages. Cars and boats and lumber and gasoline have unprecedented demand. It's definitely going to be wild to watch, and I want you to be ready for it to be wilder than you think. I think you can expect a new sexual revolution as millions of people who have been quarantined for 15 months reunite. You can expect a dramatic rise in drunk driving as people who are used to drinking at home are driving again and spending a lot more time in bars because they're so thrilled to be there. The word bacchanal has not been in favor in about 200 years, but I think it's going to come back, which is defined as an occasion of wild and drunken revelry. I think the holidays this year will be the most over-the-top display of consumerism you've ever seen. Does that sound like too much? Well, what does it look like? And this is what, David, you and I were discussing. What does it look like when 7.9 billion people feel PTSD all at the same time? When they feel the euphoria of the end of a period in which death was all around them? What does it look like when 7.9 billion people try to get over a real PTSD of a powerful hidden stress? Did any of you feel an invisible weight lift off your shoulders when you got your last shot? I know a lot of people did. And now it's going to be multiplied dramatically. So here are a few more opportunities, and maybe David and John, we can explore some of these a little more in the next few minutes. We are finally making real progress on social justice and racial justice. mostly inside companies in their workplace. It's, of course, overdue, but there's some real action taking place there. As this migrates to the external, to brand marketing, there are opportunities for genuine, authentic action, but also some real pitfalls and minefields. Another category, remote work, has ushered in a long overdue commitment for work flexibility. The return to work will be important to navigate as post-pandemic sensibilities expect more and different options from companies and brands. The acceleration in the use of data in brand marketing to track and target individuals is a major opportunity, but also a new battleground and minefield. And the meteoric rise of influencer marketing, which took on a new and more, I guess, important role as media consumption habits changed during the pandemic. That will continue, but it's going to enter a new era of scrutiny. So, David and John, I'm happy to discuss any of those. Interested if those struck any kind of chord, and if you agree with me that the Bacchanal is arriving.
I'll let John respond to the Bacchanal. But John, do you want to follow up on any of those? I know a couple of those struck a chord with you. You and I have talked about some of these themes, particularly as it relates to social justice, racial inclusion, and what that really means, how companies will either stand by that or sweep it under the rug once the pandemic's over. Did you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Rob, firstly, I haven't had the pleasure of going across all the continents with you. Perhaps that's something that yet may happen. But as you know, I basically am not from the communications world originally. I'm from a strategist perspective. So I've ended up in the same space with yourself and David and others, but coming from basically the social justice strategy space. So the Prince of Wales, sitting with the interface with FTSE 100s and the UK government over many years. So what you've just gone through, and I never thought that actually I would hear the word Bacchanal on Clubhouse. So I'm sure you are the first person to use that word on this platform. Whether or not everybody will be rushing now to the dictionaries, but and whether or not it will be used again, we'll see. But going through what you've just said, you know, this perfect storm of the challenge of brand expectation, the raw, the wild times that we've got, the acceleration of various aspects such as data and influencing. I mean, this really is that perfect storm, isn't it? And I think we face this new challenge for business and brands. And I guess where I'd go with this is exploring some of the aspects of how you think brands will be best equipped. And not just the big brands, actually. You know, smaller business people face very much the same expectations. You know, we advise, obviously, all sizes of business. But people are being buffeted by these influences, regardless of whether or not they're a founder of a business with 10 people or whether or not they're leading, you know, a major global concern. What are the sort of issues that you, well, not the issues, what do you think are the, I would say, the leadership traits that you think need to be applied in this way? And I would just also reference one thing, which I think is really important, is that if you don't mind me saying, when I first joined Omnicom 4 years ago, my interaction with Ketchum was mainly in the New York team, with the New York office, and the empathy and intelligence label that you have around Ketchum really seems to be absolutely combined in what you've just described, which is that combination of intelligence to understand the issues and empathy to then understand how they will apply, obviously, for your stakeholders. So if you're a leader, any size of business, you know, what are the sort of traits and things that you think that you've got to really have to successfully navigate this perfect storm? And I'm done.
Yes. Well, thank you, John. You know, we changed our brand promise as a firm to empathy and intelligence 3 years ago. And I am proud of the team that moved us in that direction, because I think the intelligence to know what you don't know and to figure out using data and evidence the right thing to do, but the empathy to know in your heart what's the difference between right and wrong, I think need to be kind of guideposts. We need EQ and IQ to do well in business today. And so what I would say is, you know, in your book, Truth Be Told, John, you have a lot about authenticity. And I think that's something that, as we think about social justice and racial justice in relation to brands, there has to be a genuine look at where you are as a brand. It can't be performative virtue signaling. So there has been much positive and overdue action within companies, right? Increases in hiring of Black and brown employees, very good and real diversity, equity, and inclusion programming, particularly built around retention and moving people up into leadership ranks. A lot of it has been real. We've seen some companies kind of doing virtue signaling by saying, we believe in this, but it hasn't been backed by real action, right? That's what we mean by virtue signaling. You're kind of saying you believe in all this stuff. Our head of diversity, equity, inclusion at Ketchum, Lindsay Wagner, who's phenomenal, and outside of Ketchum, she's quite an activist in the category. She says, the year 2021 is the year of receipts. You know how when you turn in your expense report, you have to show the receipts for where you went for a dinner? Well, show the receipts for the real action you took coming out of 2020. It's not the year to make the promise. It's the year to show the progress. Like, for example, our summer intern program, the class coming in is 46% people of color. That's real tangible progress, and God knows we have to make a lot more. But see, the thing that I'd like you to think about in relation to brand reputation is that that effort to do the right thing and make real progress in diversity, equity, and inclusion is now moving to the outside. And by that, I mean consumer marketing. It's moving not just to your workplace policies, but to the brand environment. And I'm telling you, look out for clumsy virtue signaling. The most obvious and early wave of this would be the sudden appearance of Black and brown people in banner ads and television ads, right? It is not enough to put a person of color, an actor, into a mainstream setting, delivering the exact same message you've been delivering to a mainstream white audience. There needs to be more diversity on the brand teams, more diversity in the agencies, so that cultural, ancestral, and other dimensions are genuinely brought forward in the form of your brand marketing. And I'd add, I don't think a brand can just chase opportunity with underrepresented markets without making real investments in them. It's a, you can pay me now or you can pay me later, but don't just suddenly discover that we're a big opportunity and don't bring some level of real community investment. And I'd say this, I've been working with clients now in the past year and a half using a spectrum. Picture this visually. If you want to sketch it down on a pad, go ahead. On the left side of this spectrum is the word acceptance. There's four stops along the way, left to right. Acceptance, allyship, advocate, and activist. We have companies and brands saying we're trying to decide if we're an advocate or an activist. It seems like everyone wants to be on that end of the spectrum. And we'll do a kind of an analysis and we'll say, I'm not sure you're even to advocate. You know, you're more like accepting of these communities, you're providing some level of allyship, but to claim that you're an advocate all the way over to an activist, that means putting money on the line and taking a position that isn't so mainstream that it's safe. And so I would say, John, in answer to your question, authenticity, thinking about it authentically, no brand is perfect and they shouldn't pretend they are. They should generally reflect where they are.
That is tremendous, Rob, and I want to come back to that. What we're going to do just before I do is a quick refresh of the room in the typical fashion. So, James, Paul, can I just hand over to you a refresh, and then I'll come back on Rob's extraordinary insights there. Thank you.
So, guys, you are listening to Managing Brand Reputation, a fireside session with the one and only Rob Flaherty from Ketchum, the global chairman of one of the biggest marketing, branding, PR agencies and communication organizations on the planet. This is room number one of a four-part series. Every single Monday, we're going to be bringing you insights from the biggest businesses in the world, talking about a variety of different subjects. Today, we're talking about the risks and opportunities in managing brand reputation in the roaring 2020s. If you would like to ask a question, please click onto the Winners Club, click the link in the bio and hit the Ask a Question button. And we'll bring in a few selected people up at the end to ask Rob their question. Handing back now, masterfully, to John O'Brien.
Thank you, James. Well, Rob, just going back, quick recap before we had that. You talked about authenticity. In fact, you very kindly mentioned the book that David and I wrote, Truth Be Told. So thank you for that plug as well. And you feature in that book, which was tremendous insight. Authenticity. I thought actually the show the receipts to the action, not the promise, is an extraordinarily powerful filter to look at the behavior of business. I think that's a huge message to take out. And that issue around clumsy virtue signaling, I mean, you're absolutely right. It reminded me, actually, if I can just share a story. Probably 15, 16 years ago, I used to take visits of senior business leaders into various locations to then often with the Prince of Wales, and we'd go back and discuss issues. And we went into one. We took the senior person from one of our major retailers, I won't say who it was, into a community which was high ethnic minority community. And when he was talking to it, some of the young black kids that were there and the ethnic minority black kids that were there were saying that they would never go in their shop. And I'm using their language here. The person that was from the business was staggered by this. And he said, well, why not? Why would you not come into our shop? And they turned around and said, because it's a white shop. Now, mm-hmm. In the United Kingdom, that was really a shock, I have to say. I don't know what it's like in the States, but that was a real shock. And the reason they said it was that was because whenever they walked into a shop, they were always followed by security. They were always looked at suspiciously. There were no ethnic minority faces in the employee base there. And therefore, they considered it not a place for them. What happened there was that that company actually realized it wasn't just underrepresentation in the employee base. It was actually the fact there was an underserved market there. This was directly affecting their ability to grow their market share. So in areas and cities and inner cities of high ethnic minority population, they were just excluding that key part of the market. And so, you know, when we talk about that spectrum that you talked about, acceptance, allyship, advocate, and activist, that's very much driven by the need for us to have the best of businesses, to lead the best of societal behavior and open up that access. But there's also an issue, isn't there, about the long-term sustainable success of businesses, not just doing it as if it's shaping society, but actually doing it as enlightened self-interest. The fact that this has got to be the way that they build a long-term sustainable business. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. In fact, I call it sustainable branding. Sustainable brands aren't looking for the quick hit. They're looking for something longer term. I've always believed that a brand is a promise, and a great brand is a promise kept. The keeping of promises is the hard part. But if you're trying to overhype a product that doesn't deliver, if you're saying you deliver great service, but what you're really doing is maximizing your sale, it's not sustainable. And so just as we think about sustainability in relation to the environment and climate change, sustainable branding is doing the right thing and taking a longer term view.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. And absolutely agree with that. And I think one of the things which, just to move on slightly, one of the things which you alluded to right at the top of the conversation, and something which we obviously are seeing across every aspect of our corporate behavior and indeed, you know, public sector, is the intense use of, intense use of data driven out of personal information, stuff that is pulled off social platforms, the way in which retailers, online e-commerce, health providers, etc., are looking at being very much more focused around meeting particular need. But a lot of that is being done through the intelligence aspect of the data that we share. That has long been seen as a way in which we can improve the ability for brands, improve the quality of service. There are risks associated with it. You know, both sides of the Atlantic and elsewhere, we've seen the risks around data protection, et cetera. But what's your view basically on that intelligence, the data, and the way in which that can be used to improve aspects going forward?
Well, yeah, let me pull us from an area of great use of data that's also run into controversy, and then relate it to the world of branding. We've all seen that in society in general, and particularly in the world of politics, data has been used very effectively to win elections, right? But now add into it the opportunity to target people who are seen as vulnerable to misinformation with aggressive disinformation that, you know, leads them down a path, a polarized path of believing falsehoods, but then voting for a candidate. Then we see in societal applications of technology, things like algorithmic bias, things like facial recognition bias, in which a young black man is more likely to be pulled over by the police because the now ubiquitous cameras in our cities have a degree of bias built into them, and they alert the units to show up in that neighborhood because they saw someone suspicious. Well, those kind of ethically questionable uses of data are now moving into the brand sphere. 4chan and 8chan in the dark web are being used to mount campaigns against brands, particularly brands that maybe take one particular stand on an issue, like, say, owning a gun. So there are huge opportunities in marketing from technology, particularly around attribution. Attribution, of course, being the ability to track which touch points you have with a consumer, a specific consumer, that add up to an action like buying your product. Data allows us to do this kind of targeting of the individual and attribution, but you've already seen some creepy examples of it. You know, if my wife orders candles on through Pinterest, suddenly I get push banner ads for candles on my New York Times feed, even though we don't share platforms. And how did they know that I might need to buy a candle too? That's minor. You perhaps have heard about young women getting diaper banner ads sent to them even before they've even told their mother that they're pregnant. They've told no one, but they're already getting diaper ads sent to them. So there can be creepy uses of data in the brand sphere. And I guess what I'm saying is we're about to enter a period in which the brand's use of data is going to be a crisis for many, many brands, just as hacking into databases of credit card companies and retailers over the past decade was ubiquitous. Now you're going to see a lot of scrutiny and questioning of how brands are using data, how much data they have, and how it is that they're able to anticipate your every move through the science of attribution. So I'd be happy to talk more about that, but I think it's a giant opportunity. I'm a big advocate of it. I call it in our field comtech. You know, there's martech, but in the public relations and communications field, we use the term comtech to describe the very positive and ethical use of technology to be more effective. But at the same time, as we come out of the pandemic, the ubiquitous use of technology is going to lead to some brands into getting into trouble.
Yeah, well, no, that's great, Robin. And indeed, you know, I think we all know that actually behind whatever technology there is, you've got the ethics of the people that are actually managing that data, the ethics of the way in which that data may be sold or marketed, et cetera, in its own right, and then applied. David, do you want to come in and take a comment?
Well, yeah, thanks, John. And thanks for that, Rob. I knew that was going to be a great answer. You and I, we both sit on the PRCA Ethics Council, and I've heard your views on this before, and I think they're instructive and informative. And I did want to follow up on a different topic, but just on this point, and use the word creepy, which I don't disagree with. You know, sometimes the ads I get on Instagram are spectacularly accurate. I mean, you know, I do want a holder for a Negroni cocktail that I can use when I'm taking my dogs out for a walk.
Fantastic.
You nailed me on that one, but sometimes it is on the other side of creepy. So is there a clear line in your mind? And is there some advice we could give to clients or to agencies or advisors on how to recognize that line before you cross it?
Well, to me, the creepiest one is algorithmic and facial recognition bias. As John was saying, if humans put it together, there was probably some bias in it. The coding was done by people who bring a lot of their, you know, unconscious bias, if you will. So that to me is the creepiest, you know, so that a black family in the rural countryside in the UK, their kid can't get a college loan because of their location and their name. And so that's the creepiest form. The other forms are when they know too much about you. And so one thing that I encourage is opt in. And you're seeing more and more opportunities to opt in. Actually, I'm seeing a flood of opportunities to opt in that are in and of themselves creepy. How many times now does the app now send you the option of, hey, we've been following you for 3 days. Do you want to have it follow you all the time or only when you're in the app? You know, it's, I don't know if you've seen a lot of those lately, but I've been seeing a ton of those. And so now you kind of go, yeah, I guess you can follow me whenever. But you're going to have 30 apps following you and triangulating on exactly. I honestly don't live such a life that I worry a lot about privacy. But, you know, I think brands have to give you the option of opting in.
Yeah, totally agree. You touched on a topic that's probably too big for us today. Maybe we can pick it up on one of the other shows on misinformation. And I think that this overlays pretty significantly with that. But I'll save that for another time because I think it's a juicier topic. I think at the top of the hour, you mentioned both some optimism and some concerns about influencer marketing. And I know you and I have been talking about whether this was a good thing, a bad thing, or something in between for, you know, probably a decade or close to it. So maybe tell us a little bit about what you think the risks are, what you think the opportunities are, and maybe where that's going.
Well, here's the opportunity. I predicted, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago at Web Summit that in the very near future, influencer marketing will be bigger than public relations. Public relations is a $16 billion global professional service category. They're either corporate and brand communications business on the earned side. Advertising, by the way, is a $600 billion business, much larger. But influencer marketing is now larger than the public relations and earned communications field. It's a $20 billion category, like out of nowhere. And my guess is our field only got $1 billion of that. You know, we did not capture that market. So it's huge. And here we're talking about, well, you know, you're all very familiar with it, but it's YouTube influencers, it's Instagram influencers, it's Pinterest influencers, it's healthcare influencers, it's fitness influencers, it's celebrities. And here's what I'd say about it. David, you've heard me say, the most valuable media in the world is the only kind you can't buy. That's a great way of introducing people to the field that we have developed over many decades. What do we mean by that? Well, you know, advertising agencies turned, you know, a great business model of selling time and space into a multi-billion dollar marketplace. Now that's on banner ads, it's on instant messaging, it's everywhere. But the ad agency, the digital agency, and the media buying shop always want to turn everything they do into a paid channel and monetize the appearance of the message. We have made it more of an art to work with journalists as gatekeepers to reach people on the more credible editorial side of the media. And now as the media becomes less important, meaning the professional news media, now we're working directly with the consumer, but with the shared message, meaning that the greatest, most credible source of any message is a recommendation from a friend. It's not a major news brand. It's not a paid advertisement. It's not a banner ad. It's a recommendation from a friend. And sometimes that recommendation comes from, that's why the influencer marketing world was invented, so that people could be that friend recommending something to you. Here's the problem. Within our firm, because we try and look at this in a multidimensional way, we have set up a kind of an approach that says, here's a group of paid influencers, always paid influencers. Here's a group of never paid influencers. They don't take a dime. They won't take sample product. And there's hybrid in the middle that might take sample product, but they'll always disclose it. And we've had to work extensively on full disclosure of the source of, you know, sponsorship. But not all players do that. Not all influencers disclose that they're being sponsored. Some won't say they're paid. Some, you know, and obviously the most credible ones are the never paid influencers. Some of you might be never paid influencers on this talk. But I think we're moving into a period of scrutiny of the influencer marketplace in which people are kind of on to this world, very much so, are suspicious of the credibility of the endorsement that they're giving and are looking for the disclosure of who's paying me for this. And I think we're going to have to see a lot more transparency around that in order for that very, very large marketplace to be effective. So that's just a thought on that.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And very, very well said. I see some questions lining up. We're running this room a little bit differently. It's an amazing room, by the way. So thanks to the team that helped pull this together. It's large and engaged, and I can't wait to hear some questions, but we're asking them in a slightly different way.
So the first person that we had up with a great question was Ilana. Ilana, are you there? If so, please unmute yourself and ask Rob your question, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much. Can you hear me okay? Thank you so much. I've just been going through my portfolio. I've done so much work with Ketchum over the years, and I just wanted to say that you're such a wonderful company. The staff, and as is reflected on the stage here, in 20 years of experience, I think, your staff are always just so incredible. So, you know, from a heart place as well. My question is, how do you think sustainability will change the language of marketing over the next 5-10 years? And do you think that's different in different regions?
It does vary by region, you know, but everyone is moving in that direction. And I think you're going to have a tremendous amount of movement in that direction and opportunity. And then again, the question becomes, is it authentically pursued? I can't tell you the amount of work we're doing at the intersection of ESG and sustainability right now. So environment, social, and governance, and with a sustainable approach to all three. The reason that this is happening, as I'm sure you know, is the pressure now is from the top. 20 years ago, the pressure was from the bottom, small environmental activists pushing for more sustainable approaches, right? Now that is joined by, first off, employee expectations that the company is going to take a sustainable approach among millennials and Gen Z, but also the largest investors in the world, BlackRock and Larry Fink and the Business Roundtable, have said it's now a board mandate to take a sustainable approach. And, you know, if you don't follow Larry Fink's letters, he's the CEO of BlackRock, the largest investor in the world. His message was, look, this is enlightened self-interest, my friends. He's saying to companies, I want you to stop building your company to deliver this quarter's earnings. That is too short term. Why does he care about that? You see, we might care about it as citizens in a very different way. We want the environment to be protected. We want the source of food, for example, to be ethically sourced. What he was saying was, I invest in your company to create a retirement portfolio for my customers that's going to be there in 30 to 40 years. If you take a short-term view and you don't build sustainable manufacturing, retrain a sustainable workforce, retraining of your workforce, making sure that you're not damaging the environment. If you don't take that long-term view, I don't want to invest in your company, and I'm not going to. We have almost physically felt the impact of that coursing through the corporations and brands that we work with, in which has become a top priority to take a more sustainable approach as a company and then as brands, which would bring me back simply to this point, which is we have to keep our eye out for, again, kind of inauthentic virtue signaling around sustainability in which people pretend. You see all the, when you buy food now, you see there's like 6 labels on the front of a bag of, you know, snacks, because they're all trying no GMOs and we're sustainable sourcing, ethical sourcing. How much of it is real? And we can help brands to always ask the question, is this real, or are you just trying to increase sales by doing something that's not all that authentic? Great question, though. Thank you.
Thank you for your answer. Really, really helpful. Thank you.
Awesome stuff. Thank you very much. Right, we're going to come next to Lucienne. Lucienne, can you unmic and ask Rob your question, my friend?
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, my question is around personal and professional branding on social media. I work with large corporations, but my personal story really infiltrates the message that I'm bringing to those organizations in ways of a nervous breakdown and my personal life, you know, having a son who is autistic, etc. How much of that do you recommend? And it sounds like a crazy question, but honestly, I think so many people struggle with this. How much of that do you recommend I show on my social media marketing to bring that personal branding to life?
Yeah, what a fascinating question and a difficult one. And I wouldn't pretend to be an expert in that. But I will say this. showing vulnerability now is a good thing. I wouldn't go so far as it maybe turns off people who aren't enlightened yet to I just so believe that we all face a huge challenge. Just the vast majority of us try to hide it. I have a talk called "We Think We Tackle Life, But Frankly, Frequently Life Tackles Us." And everyone, if they've lived just a few years as an adult, have faced challenges. And it is increasingly okay, thank God. We're destigmatizing virtually everything, particularly mental health, but also developmental needs of children as they develop. So it's good timing to be honest. One of the things I've said to corporations is you need to show vulnerability as a corporation, not just as an individual. You need to be able to say we're not where we need to be. And even our head of DE&I pushed Ketchum. She said, that's not enough. It's not enough to say we're not where we need to be. We need to be willing to say we should have done more. We didn't do this, and now we're going to be doing this. And it was a bit of a thing to swallow, but we have now, you know, writing the narrative for what we're doing about racial justice, we now say in writing, there were too many years where we didn't do this the right way, and here's what we're doing. And to me, that's an example of, you know, corporate vulnerability. But I think showing personal vulnerability is a good thing these days. And Lucianne, I wish you much courage in that journey.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you for your answer.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lucien. Very much appreciated. Right, we're going to go over next to Sarah. Sarah Grout, you asked a question via the button. Would you like to unmute and ask your question, my friend?
Thanks so much for bringing me up to the stage. Yes, I'm Sarah. I'm a regional fundraiser for a UK disability charity and a disability advocate. I was so delighted on opening the Ketchum website to read the headlining statement about the appointment of the fabulous Lindsay Wagner to head up diversity, equity and inclusion. And I wanted to ask Rob, how do you feel that Ketchum can lead the way and influence clients to follow suit and take authentic action in diversity, equity and inclusion, embedding it into their brand strategies so that it doesn't come across as paying lip service and a tick box exercise? That's my question. Thank you, Rob.
No, thank you, Sarah. I absolutely love that question. So get ready. let me go all, this is where my thinking has been going on that. First off, I do believe on a good day, we as counselors to corporations should stir the conscience of the corporation to do the right thing. We have a huge opportunity to be advisors on that. One of the values that we have at Ketchum is to be a force for good. So over the years, you can think of a PR firm as helping to shape the image of a company. You can think of it as help me say what I want to say. We have always pushed ourselves, which is why we call ourselves a communications consultancy. We say, how can we help you decide what you need to do, what action you need to take, not just the words to explain that action. But lately, I have been thinking over the course of a very long career that we missed an opportunity. It goes right to the heart of your question, Sarah. Why is it that the PR firm, the marketing firm, is always quick to help a client clean up a negative issue? We call it crisis management, right? We'll do some crisis preparedness, and we'll do some crisis response, and we'll make a lot of money out of it. Why aren't we in the crisis prevention business? Why isn't our, I wish PR had been called not public relations, but public responsibility. I think on a good day, we stand in the middle between a corporation and a brand and all of their stakeholders. And where that leads me to now is why weren't we the ones that were at the forefront of pushing for diversity, equity, inclusion? why weren't we the ones pushing for gender equity and almost the field that invented the Me Too movement? Why didn't we, as marketing communications people looking out for the reputation of companies, why didn't we start the stakeholder capitalism movement? Why in our thought leadership weren't we the originators of that thinking rather than latching onto it and becoming great positive enablers of it, which is a worthy role? But back to your question, Sarah, we should take more and more on ourselves to foresee, you know, they say the arc of history leans towards justice. It's a very long arc, but it leans toward justice. How do we help our clients to land on the right side of history and not be there just on the back end helping them communicate what they're doing? How can we anticipate and become an advocate and a force for good? So I'm glad you're thinking along those lines, Sarah. And I think it's a great question. And I wish you much luck in your work because it's so important.
Thanks. That's a fantastic answer. And I think we're in the same business of informing people or supporting people that aren't enlightened yet and destigmatizing disability, really.
Yes.
And being positive enablers. Fantastic answer. Thank you.
Sure. You know, and related to that, of course, is destigmatizing mental health, which I've yes. spent a lot of time on that. Somewhat relates to Lucienne's question too. And so I look forward to continuing that part of this discussion.
Hear, hear to that. Many thanks.
Great stuff. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Rob, for your answer as well. We're going to move next to Joy. Joy Cook, are you there, my friend? If you are, please unmute and you can ask Rob your question.
I am, James. Hi, Mr. Flaherty. It's Joy Cook, founder and president of Joy Cook PR Group. I am a study queen and have a PhD in Rob Flaherty philosophy. So I just wanted to first introduce myself properly. And then second, my question is, what do you think the role of apps such as Clubhouse and other audio apps where the creators have the power not only to have conversations, but their messages actually are syndicated. What role do you think that plays in PR? And congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Joy. You live up to your name. I think Clubhouse and other apps like there aren't any exactly like this, but are outstanding because it's more of an open playing field. It's not as hierarchical, right? Everyone can have a voice and participate. It's not as passive as Facebook or Twitter, where you're kind of watching and retweeting. It's much more real. I often joke that I've had a career in public relations, but that doesn't mean I'm relating to the public as much as I'd like. And this gives you the chance to really engage with people and hear diverse points of view. I love that it's also very multi-generational. I've had the rich opportunity to be a member of the World Economic Forum and to go to Davos so frequently with David Gallagher for the past 15 years. But guess what? You know, the average age there is, well, my age. You know, it's not multi-generational. And even industry groups that I belong to, we sometimes kind of self-criticize. One of the best groups in our field is the Page Society. I'm a proud member. I'm on the board, and I love it. But I had to wait until I was 53 to be a member. It's like, what? You know, I love this multi-generational platform here. We get to really mix it up, and I get to hear from people from many different countries and different racial backgrounds and particularly different age groups. I absolutely love it. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this. You know, they say that the wide open web, social web, where everyone sees everything, is now moving into more semi-private groups, self-selecting groups of people who are interested in you know, certain topics. Certainly Clubhouse is a good example of that. So I'm glad you are a sensor of social change, Joy, and I really appreciate the question.
Thank you so much. And are you open for potential mentorship. Sorry, guys, I have to shoot my shot. I never do this, but I studied you for so long. I'm like, if I'm able to connect, now's the time.
Sure. Use whatever platform, this platform, LinkedIn, the whole thing.
Thank you so much.
I've got to respect Joy's hustle there. Asked a great question, introed it brilliantly, and got herself a mentor, all in under 5 minutes. Fantastic. Well done, Joy. It's a masterclass in how to get what you want out of life. And if you don't ask, you don't get. So good on you. Fantastic stuff. Right, Stephanie, we are going to come to you next, my friend. If you have a question, I believe you've got a question around Gen Z.
I do. First of all, hi, Rob. It's been a long time since I've seen you.
Hi.
Nice to see you. Just for sake of history for everybody here today, I used to work down the hall from Rob, and yes, David was my boss in London, and I'm very proud to have cut my teeth at Ketchum many years ago. I like to think it really laid the groundwork for what I'm doing now, which is running two businesses. I'm an entrepreneur. I have a skincare range for Gen Z males, and my question is about them, and I wanted to talk to you today, or hope you could share with us your insights about this generation and where does this all line up for them post-pandemic as we come out of this?
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your businesses.
Thank you.
One of the things I've gotten a kick out of is I don't have a beard, which immediately identifies me as a boomer. but I get a kick out of now the growing beard section in every convenience store I go into, drugstore. They've made it a destination that arcs out at both Walgreens and CVS that arcs out into the aisle. And it's a variety of beard treatment products. And your stuff could sell right alongside that because it's obviously targeting kind of an age cohort, demographic, psychographic, and sounds like it would be ideal for yours. Well, I think we saw some of the impact of 9/11. My children were, I'm guessing, maybe 8 and 12 when 9/11 happened. And, you know, there's a loss of innocence there to having been so impressionably young. But now think about this, 7.9 billion people. Think about how this strikes to the core. You know, they say that if someone was abused as a child, it's hard to develop any trust going forward, right? Well, this wasn't as bad as child abuse, but everyone was afraid to go outside and the threat was death. So, people my age can process that a little better than someone who is 11 or 15 or 21. We all know that that age around 19 to 23 is very vulnerable for significant mental health issues because their mind is waking up to the awesome, you crash into life at that age, the responsibility. And so now layer on top of that, back to Gen Z, layer on top of that, that they had to deal with no job opportunity, a cancellation of celebration of high school and university, the strange being locked away from their friends, a whole new pattern of online behavior, leading some of them into some pretty bad behaviors, I'm sure, and some into, I know a number of introverted kids who actually kind of like this. they didn't like going to school anyway. And so there's been some little bit of a silver lining, but I really empathize. I really was not all that worried about missing a year of education because it was everyone at the same time. I know there were disparities based on economics and probably race, but for the most part, everyone missed a year of school or had it compromised. I'm more concerned about the mental health impact, the feeling that I may never feel safe again. And I think we have to appreciate that as we rally around that generation to help them cope with it. I happen to think the generation ahead of them, the millennials, are probably the best ones to be their bosses because I find millennials to have very high EQ and a much more balanced view of work life and personal life, high expectations of their employer to do the right thing. What's bad about that? A lot of boomers complain about millennials. I think they're fantastic. I think their values are better than ours in many ways. And I think it's going to be good that they're going to kind of be the supervisor for the Gen Z coming up. I hope that contributes to your thinking, Stephanie. Great question.
Awesome stuff. Just want to be mindful of Rob's time. Rob, are you all right for another 15 minutes or so?
I am.
Fantastic.
I'm enjoying the conversation.
Great stuff. Yeah, we're enjoying listening to it. Fantastic. Also, make sure you hit the notification bell because this is room number one of a four-part series we'll be running around managing brand reputation. And as I think you can hear from the insights and the wisdom that's been shared today, this is a guy who has a lot of information to share with us, regardless of where you are at in terms of the bell curve of your career. Credit Ninja, you asked a fantastic question. Are you there? Can you unmute and ask it to Rob?
Hey, thanks for having me. And of course, Bacchanal. Rob, I'm from Las Vegas. I've never heard that word outside of Vegas when it came out of your mouth. And that's the lifestyle here in Las Vegas.
Is the-
Is. I'm just like, when I heard you said that, I'm like, and I just love what you talked about in the marketing space, because Mad Men, it's like an episode of Mad Men when you started talking. So you just piqued my interest, as they say. But my question to you, and I've just been at the Wynn, I live literally across the bridge from the Wynn. If you ever been to Vegas, I don't know where you live, but
yes, well, yes, I have been. I've been to the Wynn. Yes.
Okay. My favorite hotel. But one of the struggles of Vegas is they were trying to diversify into more activities, you know, sports and so forth. And when COVID hit, it was a big blow to Vegas. And trying to get back on track, a lot of the struggles with these casinos and hotels was, what do we do to, you know, open up properly against, you know, what, you know, the CDC guidelines were advising them on. And it was very difficult because they didn't want to be the first one to put down their guards and, you know, give the mandate of like voluntary masks and all that. And so my question to you is, how would you advise hotels, travel industry companies to come back and open up without having that, you know, all these judgments with the publics and so forth? So that's my question to you, Rob. And thank you for thank you, Ashley, Paul, and the Winners Club for bringing Rob. This has been a treat. This is totally up my alley about branding and direction. Thank you so much. I'm done speaking.
Sure. Well, I'm going to show a little of my bias. I actually think we should have a vaccine passport. If you want to save those restaurants that you love so much and the tourist destinations and the airlines, we've got to have a way of saying I'm vaccinated, because it'll open things up like crazy. And I really hope that people will read the science and figure out that it's perfectly safe to get a vaccine. And I think that's what's going to open up society, and it's going to open up it up really, really fast. I think, unfortunately, the CDC in the United States, you know, they were criticized for not opening things up for too long, and now they're being criticized for opening things up too fast, because I believe that even though they were following the science, they, you know, last week they should have said, we are going to move to no masks and no social distancing if you are vaccinated in 2 weeks, because you had to give the giant retailers and everyone else the opportunity to determine their policy, instead of what I saw 2 days ago with walking up to a Walgreens, 15 people walking through the parking lot without a mask. And 1 week earlier, they'd all have a mask on, and then going, oh, I guess I have to put it on. I must have heard that wrong. Oh, but Walgreens hasn't changed their policy. So to help tourist destinations, I think they should have their own policy. If you're vaccinated, you're welcome. And if you're not, you have to wear a mask. And we probably need to go to some form of, you know, trust but verify, have some way of certifying that you've been vaccinated. So that, because I fear a wave of the unvaccinated. You see, if I have some very close relatives who refuse to get the vaccination. They've been going out to bars and restaurants. They happen to live in Florida. And so they more, that state is kind of a mixed red and blue state, and they've been, their governor has liberalized going to restaurants and bars. They've been going in and saying, see, nothing happened to me. Well, that's because people wore the mask into the restaurant, then took it off, and they said nothing happened. But now you're going to have people who are vaccinated who can carry the virus, and they're going to be exposed to a lot more virus in this environment. It's much more dangerous now for the unvaccinated than it was a month ago or 2 months ago. So I don't know. That's what's going to open up tourism. And yeah, back to the word bacchanal, Las Vegas is the global capital of the incoming bacchanal.
So to follow up with that, Robert, Craig and Jess, so if you're ever in Vegas, I'd like to treat you to whatever you want in Vegas. I am like the ambassador of Vegas, and you don't have to go crabbing. I will have the crab ready for you. So thank you for all that you've done. And all the nonprofits that you're about to embark upon and to your retirement. So I will send you a message on LinkedIn. Thank you, Credit Ninja.
Thank you very much. You've made reference to the fact that I said that when I step out of full-time work, I'm going to learn crabbing because I moved to Annapolis, Maryland, and my daughter bought me a crab trap, and I'm learning it.
Thank you, Rob and David. Sorry, Rob, over to you. I cut over you there, sorry.
No, just thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Fantastic questions. And thank you for bringing together such a great, diverse crowd.
Awesome stuff. We really, really genuinely appreciate your time. Mods and speakers, please flash your mics if you've enjoyed this conversation. What a wide variety of conversation we've had. I think it's been absolutely fantastic. Somebody sounds like they're squeaking a dog's toy, which I like even more. Never had that before, but it's the first time for everything. And just to let everybody know, this is the first of a four-room series that we're going to be running. So every single week for the next 3 or 4 weeks, we have got the pleasure of Rob's company for about 90 minutes. Make sure you go and give Rob a follow, please. Click him. Click on his face right now. He's in the top left-hand corner, the current chairman of Ketchum Globally. There's not many times you get to speak to a person who's got 40 years worth of marketing, branding, PR and communication experience. So make sure you go and give him a follow. Click onto the little green Monopoly house as well, the Winners Club, for more information about rooms that are coming up, such as the one we're doing next week with Rob. We'll be talking about managing brand reputation again, but a different aspect of it. Thank you guys for being here. Cheers for your ears as always. Thank you for being part of the Winners Club. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, everyone who's been part of it. And we'll see you again next Monday for more insightful conversations. Go give Rob a follow and go and follow the Winners Club.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.